Hey everybody, this is Justin Case, and with me, with my co-host,
Ben Stape.
And this is the first edition of the Pod Rock Podcast. This one's all about music. It's about songwriting, music gear, equipment, our favorite bands. We're excited to get this launched. It's going to be a lot of fun. And right now, I would just like to say, Ben, it's great to have you starting this new show with me. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I've been wanting to do this for a long time, and I know you have, and we don't usually get a whole lot of opportunity to really get in-depth about the things that we love about music, and particularly we're both rock-based players. I guess if you could say guitar-based. Yeah, this is going to really get into all aspects of music and our influences and why we keep doing what we're doing. And Ben, you know, some thoughts on that you'd like to share real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be all things music. We're going to go over albums, musicians, songs, theory, gear, like you said, amps, guitars, pedals, strings, picks, everything you can think of. You know, I'm looking forward to having conversations, you know, discussions about, you know, points of view.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic, everybody. And we look forward to having you on the journey with us. It's going to be a good time. Ben and I, this is a joint effort here. So you've got two hosts to look forward to every time we put out an episode. We're working on a project currently. We've known each other since 2007. I think it was 07 or 06, Ben.
I think it was 07 when I met you, and it was due to coming around the corner and seeing your office plastered with Joe Satriani and Steve Vai pictures and guitar pictures. I was like, yep, he and I are going to be having a lot of conversations and influences and music. And lo and behold, we ended up getting together and writing music at the same time. So yeah, it's been a bit, and it's been fun.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been this long. I mean, wow. I mean, you know, going on 14 years. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, some people's marriages don't even last that long.
that's a sad truth.
Yeah. So yeah, the stuff that you know, that we're going to be talking about and getting into, I'm really excited about as well. You and I have very strong opinions about a lot of different things, and I guess if anybody, you know, really sticks through what we're doing and enjoys it, you know, I hope they know that it is our opinions, and everybody else, you know, obviously has their own opinions too. Some of the stuff we talk about is just going to be through experience that you and I have gone through, stuff, gear, guitars, life. That we kind of want to share with you guys, and hopefully you guys get stuff out of it that would be helpful to you, either in recording, playing, even just listening to music and maybe having a different point of view when you actually do listen to stuff. So,
yeah, it's going to be a real blast, and I can't wait to hear. I had Ben actually put together some questions for me to kind of kick things off on this episode, and I can't wait to hear what those are. And I do a lot of flapping of my gums, and so I don't normally get a chance to get interviewed a whole lot, unless I'm on another podcast, because I do that quite often. But this is great. I mean, I feel like, you know, this, Ben, this is a vein that hasn't been tapped yet. And I don't think, now I could be totally wrong on this, but I'm not sure that there's a lot of podcasts out there that are going to be talking about the things that we're talking about in regards to specific types of gear, or why we like those types of gear, how we like to dial things in. I mean, this is going to be, if you want to get into like gearhead stuff, this is the show for you. This is how it's going to be. So I can't wait. And so with that being said, Ben, I think it'd be great if you kind of started reading off some of these questions. I want to get into this.
All right. Well, I guess then to start it off, I'm kind of curious and wondering exactly what got you into playing guitar, maybe a little bit about when you picked it up, or who was your influencer on having you pick up the six string and start playing.
I would, you know, it's kind of funny. It was kind of a cumulative thing, and it was over, you know, a number of years, probably when I was four. My sister used to watch MTV a lot, and, you know, obviously being an 80s kid, that was kind of a center stage cultural icon for music, and they had a lot of different styles. I mean, they had like everybody from Van Halen to Boy George to And you name it. That's back when MTV was like truly music television. They didn't have reality shows or any of that junk. You had Headbangers Ball. You had what? Yo MTV Raps.
Yo MTV Raps. Yeah.
But you had Unplugged. You had all these great showcases of different styles of music. But that got me into it when I saw the Steve Vai playing a double heart guitar on Just Like Paradise. I think it was on the Just Like Paradise video on the Skyscraper album that David Lee Roth had post Van Halen. But prior to that, it was the Van Halen, it was the Jump video was ultimately the thing, you know. And, you know, obviously David Lee Roth had left the band pretty close to after that record, because that album came out in 83, if you look at the liner notes, it came out, 1984 was released in 1983. So, which had Jump and Panama and all, you know, a lot of great tunes on there, just like any other Van Halen album. But that was the last one with Roth. So he immediately jumped to the, he had Eat 'Em and Smile, then he had Skyscraper. So, once I saw that, those two guys, then fast forward to probably, I'd probably say 1997. And I had this music appreciation class in high school, and they all handed out these Yamaha student grade nylon string guitars. And of course they're all right handed and I'm a lefty, but so I was kind of just like a natural. I picked up the left hand side and I started doing things on the guitar that the students are looking at me like, how are you doing that? I'm like, I don't know. I'm just playing with the thing.
Did you tell them that you strung it upside down like Jimi Hendrix? Yeah. Left-handed.
Yeah. Well, I was playing it upside down, and it's funny because I didn't even know anything about Jimi Hendrix at that time. I knew nothing about guitar players, and I didn't study the instrument, nothing. And I picked it up, and I was doing stuff like bending up to the next note chromatically, and just doing things that occurred, you know, to me naturally to do as soon as I laid hands on a guitar. And you know, it's funny that the music teacher says, all right, Elvis Presley, knock it off like that. She called me Elvis Presley. You sound like Heartbreak Hotel, you know. I was going da-da-da-da-da-da. I was doing that on like one string, you know. It was really funny. But that was the earliest, I think, the bug bit me. And I had a friend down the road from me that got, in 1998, the year after, he got a guitar from, like, his parents got him a guitar from the Sears catalog. Or from, like, the Finger Hut or whatever. And it was, like, it's called a Rock Axe. And it was, like, that, you know. But it was cool. It was, like, a black Strat-style type thing. And it was righty. And I remember sitting in his recliner. I kind of was just messing around with the thing and everything. I tried to get him to sell it to me. He's like, no, I'm not selling it. I'm playing it now. And, you know. And then that following Christmas, I ended up, my mom bought me one. And it was a righty. So I did exactly what Hendrix did. I flipped it upside down, you know, and then that kind of got it all started, to answer your question, because then I heard Yngwie Malmsteen, and then it was all over after that. Like I said, cumulative, right? And I found this compilation tape. It was a live metal compilation cassette tape I found at a Big Lots that we had in Watertown, New York, and it was one of those bargain bin cassette, you know, bins, and they'd take like that instrument, that little device to cut into it, letting you know that it's like some kind of clearance thing. And I used to remember what that meant when they either do it to a CD jewel case or a cassette case. They would, or they'd punch a hole in the case itself. And I don't remember what that is. I think it's like, I don't know if it's something marked for like, to be destroyed or what, but they had them at these. It was common to see them in clearance bins, whatever that was. I don't know if you remember that or not, but
yeah.
I heard Hiroshima Mon Amour was the first song I ever heard Yngwie on. I'm like, this guy, he's got a really kind of a, not really a highly overdriven tone, but he plays so fast and it's almost reckless, you know, like he just doesn't care, but it had an intelligence to it. And I was like, well, Eddie Van Halen had all his tapping stuff, and then when I heard Yngwie Malmsteen, it's all over. I mean, geez, you know.
So you kind of gravitated more toward the to studio musicianship kind of people, in essence, where they spent a lot of time honing their skills, mm-hmm. not necessarily in a band, because I mean, as you know, Steve Vai played with Zappa, and but he also kind of branched out and did his own thing. Eddie Van Halen being a studio musician, I think he did a lot of studio sessions, and people know him for Beat, or Michael Jackson's Beat It solo. Mm-hmm. So you kind of gravitated more toward that kind of side of the spectrum, or was it still kind of the music on top of it with those people in it that you kind of got into?
Good question. And it actually started out more of the if I heard a cool tune on the radio, I really loved it. You know, anything from Scorpions to like Scorpions, Tease Me, Please Me, you know, stuff like that.
Hey, that stuff still rings. It's still good.
Oh yeah. That's timeless. That's never going to, but, so I started with that, which I still love to this day, which gets into the songwriting stuff, which we'll cover later, but it's, then I gravitated, you're right, towards the more, honing your skills, like the upper level guitarists, where it's like you're even Planet X, they're a fusion band, kind of a, I don't want to say super group. It's not, I don't really like that term, but it's a group of really highly accomplished musicians with like Tony McAlpine, Virgil Donati, who in my opinion is the best drummer in the world, but him and Tony McAlpine and Derek Sherinian, and they kind of had a revolving cast of the bass player. They had Dave LaRue and in there for a little bit, and they had a few other guys. But when I got more into that, you're absolutely right. It was like I got into like Gary Hoey, and I was on this instrumental guitarist type track at that point. And that's when I really, really said, like, you know, I want to start learning how to do what these guys do. And it's still a never-ending thing. I'll never feel like I can accomplish what they can accomplish. But that's really that's really where it started taking off. And, of course, when you're a teenager, you have no money. You know, you're mowing lawns and stuff, but that's not enough to buy, like, a freaking tube amp or, you know, like, a signature axe or, like, a custom-made one, you know. So you're bombing
you're
around on the rock axe. With yeah, that?
You're scraping to buy the Boss foot pedal, and that's the big adventure, right? Like, oh, I just need $60 for that distortion pedal I want to get.
Yeah, and in fact, the first pedal I ever got was a Wawa pedal from my mom. It was a Steve Vai signature Morley Bad Horsey Wah, which I still have to this day, and it's amazing. And yeah, I mean, that was the thing. And then my mom got me a year after that, she got me a Johnson J Station multi-effects, you know, amp simulator, you know, thing. And it's, I still have it, you know, and that's really kind of like, you know, where things, I was like, man, I gotta figure this out, you know. But it's not like now where you have all this information available to you, where you can just go on YouTube. We didn't have YouTube. The internet was in its infancy. There wasn't anything as like, you know, high speed for, you know, what's it? 4G didn't have any of that stuff. You're lucky if you had 56K, and you know, and it's, there wasn't a lot of information out there yet. You go to these guitar players' websites, there wasn't a whole lot. Like Joe Satriani was out, so Satriani.com, Vi.com. But it really did not give you any information, because it's all for marketing their tours and their merchandise and their albums. And so, you know how it was back then. It was like the information wasn't there like it is now. And to me, that says a lot about the players at that point in time, about how they were able to establish a career and really learn the instrument. In the old days, the dark ages of information, really, when it came to like guitar stuff, and a lot of the teachers that were around back then, unless they had already been in metal bands or rock bands themselves, and really studied the instrument, they couldn't tell you what the Malmsteens and all that are doing, you know. Anyway, in fact, I took lessons in 2000. See, I'm putting all these in together because it's in a very short time period. Every year, I was pushing myself that much. And you know, I was jumping from place to place trying to find someone that could teach me something. And I had my buddy Mark Wern, he, you know, God rest his soul, he kind of taught me how to play taught me what power chords were. He taught me how to alternate pick. I'd never heard any of this stuff. And this kid had figured out because his older brother played and he knew people or bands. And that's when I started to really study the instrument. It was thanks to Mark. And you know, he's the guy. And there was no teacher that I ever, you know, up to that point that could tell me basic things. They could, like, well, this is how you play the song, but they didn't explain the fundamentals. Well, why are you doing that? Why are you playing? Why are you using a power chord? Why are you alternate picking? What is the purpose? They can't tell you. They just say, well, this is just what they do. Well, I want to know why. And that kind of started that whole journey. But yeah, there you go. I mean, it's a long-winded answer, but there it is, you know.
So yeah, most of the lessons, I think, around them were you'd go and you'd pay someone to teach you how to play guitar, right? You'd be forking out, or your parents would be, you know, forking out the money to a, you know, a guitar teacher or a music teacher. And
yeah, like 12 you'd bucks be learning a week or whatever.
Yeah, you'd be learning from them. There was a gentleman in my area. I never went and took lessons from him, but he was a really well-known player, and I was lucky enough to actually play in a band with someone who was taught by him, John LaChapelle. And he taught you a lot of fundamentals along with, you know, not just being able to play, but a lot of those skill sets to learn on how to play the instrument, not just, you know, here's a chord, here's another chord, but like you're saying, you know, the in-depth fundamentals of, you know, the skipping strings, right? Or getting more in-depth with the instrument than just, okay, Mary Had a Little Lamb, here you go, play your single notes. You know, because I've seen teachers do that and start people out, you know, which isn't a bad way. You can start with that rudimental, you know, foundry and teach them that kind of stuff. I went a different course. My experience started, I think, around, I want to say third grade. My family was always kind of into music. My dad listened to rock. He was playing stuff like Journey, Boston, Heart. Heart was a huge one, the Beatles. So he'd spin records. Date them, right? You know, vinyl's making a comeback, which is cool. But he'd spin records and play those. And I'd have a kind of a diverse exposure to it because my mom would play stuff like ABBA or Saturday Night Fever, right? So I'm getting bombarded with Magic Man and Barracuda, and then an hour later, you know, it's the Bee Gees from Saturday Night Fever playing in the house, and it just was very back and forth. But listening to that rock music, it pumped me up, right? I got this energy and vibe from it, and I was, you know, I asked my dad, I'm like, hey, you know, you've got an acoustic guitar, you know, and he'd play me like Puff the Magic Dragon when I was a kid, or he'd pick up some of the different songs that he kind of liked, and he dabbled on it, but he wasn't really focused on playing and learning that much other than just a couple songs he enjoyed. And it was, okay, well, here's a music book that teaches you some basic chords. Here's the book. Here's the guitar. Go learn it. So I got kind of frustrated after about the first day, right? You're trying to press down on an acoustic guitar when you're in third grade. And, you know, the acoustic guitar is huge to begin with. So I think I spent a day on it and then was just like, yeah, this probably isn't for me. And then fast forward another 2 years, I tried again for about 3 or 4 days and just didn't take. So I figured, yeah, this probably wasn't for me at all. And it ended up being when I was a freshman in high school, I was still really into music. And I got turned on to the band Queensryche, and the way that they were writing their songs, Chris DeGarmo was a huge influence for me on why I wanted to start playing. The song Silent Lucidity had come into airplay and was on their album Empire. And I remember just the sound with the orchestra in it, the way that the chords rang out, it got to me. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother, he'd actually had one of his buddies come over and he asked me to come sit in the room with him real quick and just try to play this like 3-note riff over and over again for him. Right. And I was just like, yeah, sure. Why not? I got nothing else better to go and do at the moment. And I was sitting there for probably about 20 minutes, and I got done, and he was like, hey, you need to learn guitar. And I was just like, all right, well, you know, I tried before, let me give another shot. So one of the first things I did was, okay, yeah, you got to learn some of those basic chords, but I really wanted to learn silent lucidity. So I was challenging myself with some of those odd chord structures kind of from the get-go, and the finger placement and the finger picking at the beginning of that song. So that kind of got me into it. And of course, you know, it was kind of toward the tail end of the 90s. I still loved 80s music, you know, growing up and listening to Rat with Warren DeMartini. His his playing is just amazing, and always has been.
Underrated.
Kind of stuff, yeah. So I don't remember exactly how many audio cassette tapes I wore out and wore down, just trying to learn some of the techniques and the songs that I really enjoyed. So that was kind of my school of hard knocks, right? It wasn't going and paying someone to teach you how. It was grab as much knowledge as you can, learn from everybody's kind of style, and then try to come up with something that's your own and bring out you and what gets you and excited and enjoying music, right? And hopefully the stuff that I write, you know, I try to sit back and get that vibe out and get that feeling that got me excited as a kid when you're jumping up and down on your parents' bed, you know, with Heart blaring in the background or Journey or Boston. You know, you just get that energy from those songs, that rock music. So that's where my angle came from, as far as getting into it and playing it. And then, you know, from there, it's like you said, you know, you try to get your first guitar, which I borrowed guitars from people. There was a guy that had a Les Paul that my brother was playing with, and it wasn't necessarily for me. So, you know, trying to find other different guitars my friends would have, because I didn't have one. I didn't have the money for one, but I saved up, and my first one was an ESP guitar. And I remember going and asking my folks, I was like, hey, I'm gonna buy this. I'm going to get this. And, you know, anything you want to do to chip in, if you need me to mow lawns, if you need me to, you know, clean the house, whatever it is. And, you know, sure enough, after a couple months, I had put it on layaway and bought it. So that was my first guitar that I owned, that I could actually call my own. And I still have it to this day. It's been a long time owned, and it's roadworthy for sure.
Yeah, that's an Eclipse you've got, right?
This is the MX2 Deluxe.
Is it that Les Paul style one?
No, that's the other one.
Does it have is that the one with the Floyd on it, or is it just the regular?
Yeah, it's the M2 Deluxe edition, which I think they've gone on to like a different variant of it now. But a lot of the bands that I liked around the time that I bought it was, you know, Metallica was using ESPs. They still do.
Yep.
Queensryche, you know, Chris DeGarmo, he was a huge influence. Obviously, like I said before, they were using ESP guitars. So I kind of, it was one of those here, you know, if you have an idea of what you like, go get it. And luckily enough, the shops around here, they were selling ESPs. But I definitely wanted one that was, you know, not a Strat style, not a Gibson style, but more of a rock music, right? With the
you wanted what they call super Strat in the old days. You wanted something that was like sleek and easy to play, and that was the thing with like that guitar you've got is it's got a, you know, is it a five-way blade switch on that, or is it a three-way?
No, it's a three-way toggle. But the thing for me on it is it's got the Seymour Duncans. But it had 24 frets. Like,
you know, two octaves.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. Well, there's 22, right? On most standard guitars. I'm like, but you see, this one has 24. It was like a selling point for me. Like, oh my God, I can get two more frets in there, right? I can get higher up.
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing is like, you know, I mean, a Strat, your typical Strat, it depends on what run or what year they were doing it. Cause some of them, you know, 21 frets was the best you're going to get. And some of them were just, you know, even less, like, what, 20 frets, you know? Because I think, like, it depended because I think, and I am not a Strat expert, okay? But I know that the thing with those is that that was the first style guitar that I had was a Strat, and just because that's what was, I was like, well, my buddy had one, and this I'll just get one of these, you know. And I didn't know anything about pickups or anything or any of that crap. And so it was interesting to hear that, you know, you had the wherewithal to say, hey, I want something, you know, that's going to, like, shred, you know. And, like, really shred. I don't use that in a loose sense. It's something, if you want the option to play some faster stuff, you've got it. Because, you know, a guitar like that's got the, I don't know if that one's got the 20 or the compound radius fretboard or not, but I know a lot of the Jackson stuff is compound radius, which that means the frets will not choke out when you get up towards the up in the, you know, the high 20s of the frets. They won't fret out on you.
Yeah, the upper register. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's in fact, I've got a Jackson Randy Rhodes coming in. There was a weather delay, but it's going to be here tomorrow. And it's got a compound radius on it. So that'd be nice because I've never played one with that. I do have that Red Jackson that I've had since 2000. So I bought that with my own cash. And you know, the funny story was about that was that I bought a guitar in 1999. I had some money left over from a financial aid check, like $50 to put towards it. And I ended up buying a black Squire Strat. And then I turned it in to have money to put towards the Jackson, and I was sad that I turned in, I traded in the Squire, right? I started to miss it, you know, because it was my first quote unquote real guitar. So then my mom was like, she had heard how much I missed it. She went up to the music store I traded it into, and it was under the Christmas tree that year.
Oh, nice.
So I was like, man, she was a great lady, you know. And so she always, like, supported what I wanted to do. She knew it meant a lot. So that was really cool how that worked out. So now I got my old guitar back, you know. And then I got this awesome Jackson. It was like I washed dishes, you know. And it was like I'd saved up, like, $400 because I worked all this overtime. In about 2 weeks' time, I had, like, $400, which was like I've hit pay dirt, you know. And
you could have rented an apartment back in the day, right? That was awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's a neat axe because, and much like yours, I never changed anything on. I don't think you swapped all those pickups, did you? They came with Duncans, right?
It came with Duncans on it. And it just it sounded great out of the box. I know some players take the pickups out off of an ESP and they put in other ones that they find better suiting to either their play style or the sound they're trying to get. But
right.
I've always enjoyed Duncans, and you know, most of the ones that I have out of the five guitars that I own, most of them have Seymours in them. So, but yeah, I'm gonna ask you another question.
Yeah.
And this is gonna bounce back to when you were young. What was the first album or cassette that you bought with your own money that you owned?
Ooh, cassette, that's a hard one. Does it include yard sales or, you know, I would...
it's the first one you ever had in your hands that was like, yep, I bought this. This is mine.
I'm going to have to go with CDs on that. Oh, boy. Gosh. There was like, oh, okay. Okay. Hang on a second. It was Boston, Don't Look Back, because I had purchased the vinyl at a thrift store called The Impossible Dream in New York, Watertown, New York. So I wanted the follow-up, and so I found the cassette at Ames, or it was either at an Ames or Kmart, which Ames, if you lived in the Northeast in the 80s and 90s, like, discount retail was, like, king. Anyone who couldn't afford to shop at the mall would go to, like, a discount chain, and they had tons of cassettes and CDs and records. Well, not really records, but cassettes. So, yeah, I'd have to say Boston, Don't Look Back. And the first CD I ever got was, it was actually a twofer. It was Van Halen, Diver Down, and Pink Floyd, Division Bell. I bought those on the same day from, from Walmart, you know. And that was cool. So there you go. Yeah, Boston was great, man. You mentioned Boston. I got all giddy because Tom Schultz, just a genius inventor. He built all his own amps, modified his guitars to do, you know, added toggle switches. It's, you know, he made a Les Paul do things that would sound like you'd be using an ESP style or a Jackson style. It's like he's using a Les Paul, you know, and doing all this cool tapping that was different from what Eddie Van Halen was doing. And, I mean, he invented the Rockman guitar, which was an 80s, that small compressed speaker, they would mic that, and that compressed chorus distortion sound, which you use on everything from cartoons to movies to sound, you know, soundtracks, everything for rock. That was his Rockman amp. So, yeah, those are the ones. Boston's so awesome, man. I mean, they have multiple solos in their songs, and it's tasteful, you know.
And, yeah, their musical composition was off the chart. I wish I'd actually had a chance to see them live. They did a lot of studio work. I can still remember the cover. It looked like alien spaceships, almost like a squid looking thing. On the record case that my dad had, it's crazy
it was
how you remember
to be a
that
guitar
kind of
ship.
Like yeah.
Yeah.
So, along with the first cassette, what album are you most currently have listened to or are listening to?
I've transferred everything onto my computer, and I use the Windows Media Player, or I have a playlist in YouTube. But I think probably Petrucci's new solo album. That one's great, and also. The last Dream Theater album, actually. But I think what I'm really high on the hog on right now is probably... There's a guitarist in Italy. His name's... I'm going to say his name wrong, but his name is Marco Sfolgi. Folgi. And he's amazing. And there's a song called Genius that he did. And there's... his keyboardist, Alex Argento, put it on YouTube, and I love that song. It's really prog, but it's like prog shred, you know? Like, and it's just so cool. That's what I've been listening to a lot. Anything from, like, Virgil Donati, probably, and, like, you know, Dream Theater. That's currently what I'm listening to, and John Petrucci, you know? So, and I can't wait for that new JP 2C amp to come in, but I'm on a back order list for that, so... Hopefully by next month, mid-March, they said. So I'm currently listening to probably, I'd say, John Petrucci right now.
Yeah, I'll have to welcome you into the Mesa camp.
Yeah, man, your Hashtags sound are really awesome. So I'm really excited about that, actually.
Yeah, that's been a jewel for me. I'm trying to remember what year it was that I bought that. It was my first big purchase as an amp. The first amp that I had was a Fender M80. With just a single 12 in it, and you know, it did okay, but it just didn't have that growl, you know, it didn't have that tone. And I remember getting that amp. It was on sale. It was used. It was a Mesa Boogie dual rectifier and
Rectoverb, right?
Tremoverb.
That's right. I keep seeing it. But no, the reverb on that sounds amazing.
It's a great amp, and
yeah, it's nice.
Once again, it's roadworthy. I think that's why I've kind of gravitated to some of the instruments and stuff, amps, the footboard, stuff like that that I've used, just because it's been used for years. Not to make people think that I'm like, you know, a ZZ Top beard kind of guy, you know, looking, but. you know, spending a lot of time going and traveling with it in a van, you know, up to Seattle, playing shows there, obviously in my hometown here, Spokane.
Oh, see, you did gig with that in Seattle.
Yeah, I hauled awesome. That thing everywhere.
It didn't get stolen.
you know, luckily enough, it didn't. I remember exactly one show that I was actually, I woke up in a hotel room, and this was my younger years. Not remembering how I got there after we had played a show at the Central Saloon in Seattle. And I was so excited about playing there because Alice in Chains got their start there, right? And
yeah,
they were, you know, Jerry Cantrell's another huge influence on me. I liked Alice in Chains' music and his the tone and the vibe that they brought. But
oh yeah,
so playing there was like this huge thing for me, right? And it was for other people in the band too because they were big Alice in Chains fans. And you know, one thing goes to another. You're excited. You're having a good time. You're partying with people and drinking too much. And I don't remember really how we got to the hotel that night. And all the gear was in the van that I had driven. And my roommate at the time managed to drive the van to the hotel, get everybody in there. And I woke up and I just remember walking through the foyer, you know, leaving after checkout. Like, man, how the heck did I end up here? And at that point, I was just like, yeah, okay, I need to maybe tone it down a little bit, right? Because, you know, being in charge of everybody's gear, because they throw it in the back of your van, you know, is it kind of a responsibility when you're talking about $1,000 equipment, you know, yeah, drum kits, other people's amps, guitars, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So you were kind of like the roadie gear manager guy. That was like your spot.
Yeah, I kind of did it all.
I think I remember you telling me that, yeah, before. Yeah, I never knew the hotel story though. That's funny.
Oh yeah, there's a lot more stories that we could probably get into and probably will on other podcasts. But yeah, it's really difficult, and I think even when you read about some of the bands that came out of the 80s or even in the 90s, some of them are just lucky that they stuck together. I mean, like even Pearl Jam after their first album and second album, you know, they had some of their own struggles, drummers coming and going, and you know, the music industry is not, you know, it's not all parties and you know, confetti all the time and enjoyable. There is a deeper side to it, and it's very harsh.
Yeah, I've had professionals tell me that, like guys that have been in it for decades, like, yeah, it's brutal. Just gonna tell you.
Yeah. Some people don't get married because, you know, they sell their soul to, you know, just to be in the industry, and they miss out on a lot of other things in life too. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, being a, you know, trying to hold five different personalities together, on top of writing music and then trying to, you know, keep people motivated, book shows, you know, travel, pay for the travel. It's a lot. It's a lot of responsibility, and you know, if you're not the type of person that wants to take that on, then you're the other member of the band that gets to, you know, get trashed every night and, you know, wake up in those hotels and not remember how you get there on a daily basis and not worry about it. But I was always kind of the responsible guy trying to corral the troops, if you will, to get from point A to point B and make sure they show up on time. And at least can perform, you know, because some of the guys did pre-partying too. So that's, you know, that's another discussion too. You know, you have that responsibility. Some people just don't dive in and give you that same respect that you're trying to give them. But
yeah, well, it's when they're not having to do any of the work, it's easy to act like a jerk. So yeah, so. That's interesting. So what kind of songs did you guys play in Seattle, like when you did gigs anywhere? I mean, I saw some of your stuff in the last few years. You know, it's just, you know, it's like a lot of classic rock stuff. But what were you guys doing in Seattle?
So the stuff that we were doing is kind of an interesting mix. We had a singer that was more into like Killswitch Engaged. So he kind of had that style of singing. Where he, you know, he'd sing a little bit, but then he'd scream.
Oh, I can't handle. Yeah.
So the music itself was, once again, is interesting because we had a classic rock guitar player, Rob, the guy that I played with, and then me that I was, you know, I was into the prog rock and the some of the classic rock, but more the 80s. A lot of people call it the hair metal, hair band era. And then a bass player that liked funk, but still liked some of the metal music that was coming out. So, and then we had a drummer that this kid was super phenomenal, super young, very talented. And he was into like a Perfect Circle, and not just doing straight beats, you know, in between each sections of the song or the verse, the chorus. He really came up with intricate fills and interesting style of playing on top of it all. So it was kind of a mesh of all of that that we were doing and trying to play.
I jammed with both of those guys.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that to me before.
It was a good session. It was great.
They had mentioned, I think, that they had jammed with another guy, and I was like, oh, what kind of stuff are you guys doing? And like, well, I don't know if we're going to do it or not. And I was just like, okay, well, you know, that's cool.
His dad was a good drummer. His dad came in and, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like a clone of his dad. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But dad comes in and starts playing drums too, and I was like, wow. And they didn't use like, you know, like proper acoustic, you know, tile. They had styrofoam that they had freaking stapled or nailed to the ceiling of this little room, and it was in the basement, and it was kind of weird.
Yeah, that's where we recorded our album. It was in that tiny
room. Yeah, so I was there, you know, that's funny. And they were stoked about me, like, oh man, you're great. And it's like, and I was like, I went to the Taco Bell there afterwards, and we're just, me and the singer were talking about, wow, this is great. We're both on cloud nine because it was so fun to jam out with other people. But the song that we probably jammed there for, I don't know, probably about an hour. We did some freestyle stuff, but the singer was kind of really, really flaky. And every time we had something good going on, he just kind of, I don't know about that. I'm out of the next thing now. I want to be like the Beatles. And I'm like, you're wasting my time, dude. Get out of here, you know. But the bass player was great. He was really good. I got along with him very well. But he was flaky too. He's like, well, I'm already in four other bands, blah, 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 and everything. And, but yeah, I mean, I who knows whatever happened to that kid, that drummer kid.
He moved down to Florida. This has been quite a few years ago. He moved to Florida and went to recording school, to kind of pursue, you know, being an engineer and being a studio guy, which, you know, hats off to him to chase that dream. Like I said, he was a youngster. He was like I was when I was, you know, 18 years old and trying to pick up gigs with bands, you know, and being the bar band and playing cover tunes. When you're 18, they have you sit on the stage the whole time. You can't leave. They bring you the cup of water because they don't want you coming off the stage at all, because you're really technically not of age to be in the bar. And he was same way. He took it like a champ. You know, he was all about it and just there to have fun and enjoyed the experience. So
mm-hmm. Much different lifestyle for you guys here than I had in upstate New York, I tell you that much. And it was the music scene. There was no music scene up there. And if you wanted one, you went to Syracuse, Rochester, Cortland, which is a college town. And I saw Tool, Perfect Circle. My brother would drag me to these things. I saw Yngwie Malmsteen live in Buffalo, at a place called the Sideshow Music Hall, and that's where I blasted out the hearing in my right ear. It still rings to this day from that PA system that was hanging from the ceiling, but that's another story. About, that's cool. And I think that's kind of that kind of says a lot about me and you when, you know, I think it comes out in the stuff we've recorded together. And, you know, we don't have a large body of work just because of life, but currently, you know, Ben and I, we are working on some stuff together right now. We're going to try and get a bunch of songs done. And, you know, we've been working together a lot with gear and kind of like, hey, do you need this? Do you need that? You know, how can we help each other out? And, you know, we've already had some kind of like bumps in the road just with freak things happening already. And, you know, the rule is that when you're doing something right, something's going to fight you. And that's, we've already experienced that. So I'm excited. I don't care. I think adversity brings excitement and it makes you want to do more and push and persevere. And that's what I'm liking about this already. And it's cool. And, you know, you'll hear, our influences are so different, you know, but at the same time, there's a commonality there because we're both melodic people, but we play very different. I mean, you know, as we've already described in this episode near the beginning, it was in the midpoint, it was it's those influences that we bring to the table. And I mean, Ben, you're kind of like a riff guy, you know, you're a riff guy. And it's coming up with riffs. It kind of reminds me of, like, you know, you read, like, interviews of, like, Ozzy Osbourne, how, like, you know, he always, like, really, the musicians are writing the tunes, and he would just be like the George Lucas and say, oh, this sounds good, let's do that, you know. And the bass player would come up with a doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, you know. And then you have, like, you know, Don Airey and Bob Daisley and all these guys writing all the songs, and, you know, just started from a riff. And but I think that's cool. It's not an easy thing to be creative unless you're creative. And if you come up with riffs real easy, that definitely shows a creativity there. Then that's what you need, because I'm gonna just do a mini rant here and say I am sick and tired of all these YouTube people on here doing covers. Okay. And I'm sick of it. And write your own stuff. And use your head. And if you can't be creative and come up with your own stuff, I don't want to hear it. Someone's already done that. That's someone else's gig. That's someone else's style. Take from them their style and incorporate it into your own voice. And quit copying other people, because, and you know what, and I've talked to my wife quite a bit about this. She goes, all they're doing is memorizing patterns. They're not an artist. They're just a copycat. They sit on their bed and do these videos, and you've got young girls that, like, get their hair and their makeup on and their boobs sticking out, and look, I'm doing this Hendrix thing. But this is garbage. Okay. That doesn't do anything for me, I can tell you that much. Musically, you know, I want to hear new stuff. And I'm tired of the jukebox thing. You know, and I'm not talking about cover bands. I'm talking about people that don't even go out and play live. Okay, because they're too afraid, and their fragile egos are too afraid to go out and actually be in front of people. Let me tell you something. Everyone has that issue. You know, mine will never go away. And I just heard an interview, actually. I think it was Eddie Trunk. Eddie Trunk was interviewing Wolfgang Van Halen, because, you know, Eddie Van Halen passed away here not too long ago. And so, you know, he was doing an interview with Eddie Trunk, and he says his dad always suffered from stage fright and get real nervous every day, even up to when he was his last gig he was playing. And that's normal, but it's something you have to deal with as an adult. And, you know, that's part of the gig. You know, you're going to be petrified. But you know what? That's just the rite of passage, and it's always going to be with you. So I would encourage anyone who's just, you know, sitting in their bedroom, just copying other people, stop. Take that music you hear, really think about what it is they're doing and why they're doing it, and make your own style. Now, some people just aren't wired that way. I get it. You know, there's people that are... you'll have an orchestra, right? They're always going to have sheet music for sight reading on their stands. But I'm talking about just the people that have an instrument. Maybe their parents have some money to work with, and they got an Axe FX, and they've got, you know, a camera or an iPhone or something where they can make videos and everything. And this day and age makes it very easy. I mean, you can have, you know, just a phone, you know, and all the Apple stuff is all linked together, which is what everybody uses. Which I think is a joke, but I just think that write your own stuff, because, you know, that's only cool for so long. And now that everybody's doing it, it's really not special anymore. Uniqueness and taking, you know, the 12 keys we have to work with and doing something new, I think is really, for me at least, that really is an exciting thing and a wonderful thing. Use your God-given gifts and don't. Someone's already, you know, wrote half the songs that are out there that people keep copying. It's like, it'd be like, say, I'm going to learn every Malmsteen song. Well, that's his thing, you know. Maybe for practice purposes, because it'll make you faster and stuff if you understand what he's doing and the key changes. And if he borrows from another key mid-solo, or learn the chords that he's doing. He uses a lot of inversions. You know, learn the modes that he's using. I mean, It might be boring, but that's what's going to make you a better player and a better musician, because you never know. I mean, after all this COVID crap stops, you get an opportunity to go jam with, like, some really good musicians. You're going to have to know this stuff. You're going to have to be able to turn on a dime. And I can tell you, for me, I've spent the last 2 years exploring this stuff because I want to get better. Can always improve.
You know? Yeah, I think, if I can echo some of the stuff you're saying, I would encourage anybody that's picking up an instrument. It's good to have, your idols. It's good to have a good round ability to listen to a lot of different types of music. You're going to only gain knowledge. But definitely, like you're saying, use that to be creative. And it's some people, it's easy. Some people, it's not. You really have to work at that craft and that art. And when you get that repetition and you just play, right? Just sit down and play, not anybody else's stuff, but just play whatever. For me, I would encourage anybody to do that, even for just 10 or 15 minutes, when they're jamming out, or even after they got done playing. Say you want to learn a whole entire album from Bob Dylan to whoever you want, right? Take 15 minutes after you've been done playing and just play on the guitar. Don't think about what you're trying to do. Just play on the guitar, and maybe something will pop out at you that is unique, and you take that and you run with it, and you get that vibe. There are so many topics that I know that we're going to get into on different podcasts about equipment, recording equipment, our ideas of what's good to use and not good to use. That kind of experience is awesome. I wish I had that growing up. A lot of it was kind of learning it on my own. Brings up the other topic of that, just playing it and writing your own stuff, is if you get an opportunity to play with other people, you're going to get challenged and you're going to learn, right? Don't be afraid. If you think someone else is so much better than you, and don't be intimidated. There's plenty of articles, information, interviews with people that are famous or people that have been in the music industry for a long time that look at other people's uniqueness. Even if they're not a shredder, they can write something that's unique, right? And it makes them stand out. So don't be shy if someone can shred on a guitar faster than you. If someone can write a riff and you can play over the top of it, you're going to have your own unique skills. And just learn from other people, learn from other musicians, spend that time soaking up that knowledge, which is part of what we're trying to do here on this podcast, right? Share some of that knowledge, share some of that experience out with, people that want to listen to it, that are into it. And hopefully maybe, we encourage other people to take that time and expand that out, because it's becoming a lost art. There's so many people now that have so many electronic, equipment and plugins that it's easy to write something that I would consider could get thrown out on the airwaves fairly easy, right? But coming up with your own stuff, yeah, it's scary to put your own heart and soul into it, and then you put it out there for people to judge. It is scary, but you know what? If you can walk away knowing that you put your heart and soul into it, nobody can take that away from you.
Absolutely. I hear you.
That's something that I learned in my years of writing and playing live. I still get nervous playing. But when you write something and you put it out there, that's even another scary thing, because you're showing a vulnerability of your side. You're putting your emotions into that music, and then people have – everybody judges. Everybody's going to have an opinion.
Yeah.
But what they can't take away from you is the fact that you created that. They didn't. Right?
Let's see them do better. If they're,
Challenge yourself to do better.
It's easy for people to take pot shots when they don't do anything. And a lot of people, let's be honest, they're lazy. They don't want to learn. Okay, so I'm not going to say, but let's just say that, over the years, I have tried to, people say, hey, I want to learn how to play. All right, let's do it, And what you'll find is, like, this is too hard. I can't do this. And which I disagree with. I think a lot of people, if they you know, they give something some effort, you're going to get good to a certain degree. But I guess, you know, the bug has to bite you, Ben, the musical bug. And maybe a lot of these people that, to which I would say, if you're afraid to do it, don't be. But if you're someone who, you know, some people, the bug just doesn't bite them and they don't stick with it, you know. But for me, and I know for you, it chooses you and you can't get away from it. You have to feed it. You can't get away from it. And
yeah, absolutely.
It's just, yeah. And so for me personally, I don't care what anyone thinks of what I, you know, I don't even listen to negative stuff anymore at this stage of my life. Now, if I would have been petrified to put music out if I was in my 20s or whatever, but one thing you have to remember to mirror what you said, Ben, is that even the best players in the world get criticized for ridiculous things, or he plays too fast, or you hear one song as you heard it all, or they're sloppy, or they're too slow. It's like, I don't like their tone, or I don't, you know, whatever, they're ugly, I don't know. But it's you can't be a people pleaser in music, and you certainly can't be one in the music business, and because you're not going to make everybody happy, never. So what you need to do is take the stuff that, you know, like you said, Ben, that you've worked so hard on, you know, you did the best you could, and you stand behind it with pride, and no one can take that away from you, you know. And it's just like anything else. You got a job, you're working a, you know, a day job, or there's an effort you're doing. You know, as long as you know that you threw all of your heart and soul into it, let's see them do better. If they got such great ideas, let's see them pick up the instrument and start playing. Can't do it. They can't do it because a lot of those people are cowards, and they, you know, they're satisfied just to sit back, eat Doritos, drink Mountain Dew, and take pot shots at people through comments on the internet.
Well, it's always cool when you get someone that likes stuff or can connect with stuff that you do, right?
Yeah, right.
When you write something and you have somebody come up and you say, you know what, that song really made me feel this way, or I really got this vibe or this energy from it, or this made me feel a certain way. It's a compliment to what you're doing. And even to the people that are out there writing music, even if, you know, it's easy to write something, challenge yourself. Listen to what you're doing. Pay attention to it, spend the extra time, and try to make it as good as you can. And I'm going to quote George Lucas on this one. Your project is never finished. It's abandoned, right? You can sit, and I still even do this with the music that I write. I will come up with ideas even after I've completed it and said, okay, I'm done, right? You can always figure more things out on the stuff that you're doing, but spend some quality time, you know, thinking about the mix, thinking about how you're writing it. You know, is it flowing right? I think that would help a lot of you know, aspiring people and people that are trying to write out there to challenge themselves to do better. And you and I've talked about this, I think, you know, quite a few times, is that, you know, you don't ever want to be completely satisfied for what you're doing, because you want to have that edge, you want to have that drive in it. And you want to put out something that is substantial, not just, okay, I'm going to throw it out there just because I threw it together in 5 minutes, right? It takes you and I, you know, besides our normal day jobs, it takes a while to put music out, because we're writing our own music. We're writing the bass line. We're writing the guitar parts. And then after you're done recording, you're mixing it, you know, you're mastering it, and then you're putting it out. And it takes that amount of time. If we did a day job, we'd probably have more music out. At least I know I would, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I know you would. But, you know, you and I don't want to just put stuff out that is just putting it out for the sake of putting it out, right? You want to try to have quality.
Well, yeah, especially if you're – well, I think that I'm always very closely guarded with my stuff when it comes to, like, you know, putting it on streaming services, because they're making money off of you. Even if they're not paying you, they're getting clicks, they're getting money somehow, like Spotify and places like that. And I just, you know, I want to make sure, though, that if it's going to get circulated, that it is the best it can be. And, you know, one thing to remember too is, like, I mean, every time a band comes out with something, a record, it's like, you know, they're going to vary in quality from, hopefully, from, you know, on a gradual scale on the upward, you know. Listening to, like, Van Halen, you know, the first Van Halen album, you know, and then you listen to, by the time you get to Balance, you know, the production value's through the roof. I mean, just technology gets better, you get more seasoned as a band, some members come and go, and some are better than others. There's all these factors, and yeah, and I know I've had to teach myself to be, you know, to be comfortable with the fact that, like, you're probably always gonna, you know, have a better song or a better, you know, sense of what you're doing as time goes on, even now. And, you know, I that's something that I personally have had to be comfortable with. And I want to get out and play live gigs again. That's been a very long time, especially with all this crap going on. It's like, you know, but I would say, Ben, you know, everything that you've said, it's like, I would encourage, you know, people out there that would are going to listen to this, hopefully you listen to the whole thing, that, like, we need to band together as musicians now, because we're the ones that are going to have to bring this out to the public, you know, our, you know, playing, you know, our own stuff and being that creative force, because unfortunately the industry, the entertainment industry, has robbed real musicians, and they always have been for decades, like, real recognition of their talents. And I think that that is a horrible thing, and I think it's up to us to be able to, in large numbers, we need to band together, because, Ben, like you're saying, it's becoming a lost art. Well, we can bring back the Rubik's Cube, you know, but there has to be enough people to go out there and make a statement with it. And I think that if people see someone accomplish on an instrument, it would inspire maybe young kids or someone to get in on this and maybe have a new, you know, subsequent generations of musicians, because we have to carry the torch, because if we don't, it's going to disappear. And, you know, put down the video games. You know, if I could go back in time, the first thing I would say is, I wish I didn't play so many video games. I wish I would have practiced my guitar more. And, you know, that's one of my things. Now I'm playing catch-up, because to get to the level I want to be, I have to play catch-up now. It's a desperate move at this point, you know. And I'm just getting real here. And so I would encourage, you know, if you're a teenager or maybe a little younger, even if you're in college, you know, put down the video games, because those things are addicting. Be addicted to your instrument and be addicted to music, because that's going to carry you forward. Video games come and go. Servers get shut down. They're hollow pursuits and hollow victories. Nobody cares in the real world. But if you can accomplish something on an instrument and write your own music and get it out there for the public to enjoy and consume, that's something special. And that's one of the goals that's going to be for this podcast, is to inspire people to get out there, write their own music, and share it with people. Take those the inspiration that you get from your favorite players, and let it grow within you and come out with your own stuff, and let's band together. I know it sounds like a really cheesy kind of grandiose objective, but that's what my intent is. Because all the people that me and you, Ben, that we listen to, they're getting older. They're not going to be around. And, you know, in fact, I heard an interview with Richie Blackmore, you know, and he's just like, you know, our band members are dying off. We're not going to have a reunion. They're all in their 70s. So it's up to us. We have to be the folks to do it.
Yeah, I hope that we can definitely inspire people. I hope that, you know, if we get people listening to this, they will. I would encourage people to leave comments where they can. We have a Twitter page. Hopefully people can, you know, give us feedback. Definitely.
The handle is at PodRock1.
So when you're on there, we're going to probably do a lot of different topics. We'll probably do top favorite bands, five albums that we enjoy. We're going to cover so many things. If there's stuff that you want us to talk about, or that we've touched, or that you think that you want us to go more in depth on, definitely leave comments for us. We'll take a look at them. We'll try to get back out. If anything, I definitely want to give people a shout out for that support that they'll give us. So please, you know, keep this conversation going. I mean, not just for us, because we can sit here and talk about music all day long. But yeah, part of inspiring it's getting that feedback out there so we can share the knowledge that, you know, we've had as well.
Yeah, I didn't set up a Facebook account because I hate Facebook. But Ben, if you want me to, I will. But I at Podrock Podcast 1 is our Twitter handle, folks. So drop us a line. You know, let us know. Let's hear your comments and topics, anything. And I mean, I'm really excited about this. And you know, I've got my other podcast, but I never ever get a chance to talk about music to the level I want to talk to about. And a lot of the people I interact with on there, they're not doing this. I can't expect them to go to this level. So I think this is a great outlet. And you know, and you and I talked about this for a while, and now the fact we've actually made it happen is awesome. So,
and yeah, it's gonna be a lot of good stuff. Absolutely, a lot of good stuff. I'm looking forward to talking about all the great things that, you know, that is music, that was music, that will continue to be music. It's yours and my passion. So hopefully we're not too long-winded, and people will get a little bit of enjoyment out of what we're kicking on here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's people that are, you know, into the same thing we are. They're going to listen to the whole thing. So, I mean, it's, you know, and yeah, the world needs to hear our podcast, that's for sure.
Well, hopefully we can start, and I know this is kind of in the works and we've talked about it. We're hoping to get other guests to come onto the show, people that either have been in the industry or do other podcasts in music. We're really going to try to hone in on some of that if we can and get some guests on here that, you know, they might be able to share some of their experiences that they're having even now. I know that the music industry has changed so drastically from even when I was playing as a kid to even now. And even the people out there now with the pandemic going on, they're trying to find ways to continue to make a living at this or, you know, keep doing what they do. So, you know, maybe get some of those folks on and share some of their thoughts on what, you know, you can do or we can do, and or just have a nice chat with them.
Yeah, and guitar sales are at an all-time high, by the way. The guitar is not dead, thank you. In fact, prices are going up on guitars because of the pandemic, because more people are, well, I got time to play this now. I don't have to drive 2 hours a day to work and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I think it's a great time to start this podcast, you know. I think it's a wonderful thing. So, yeah, that's awesome stuff. So, Ben, do you have any other questions for me?
Trying to think. I had another one, and I'm trying to think if I should ask it now or if it should be another topic for another time.
I'll give you a quick answer.
Okay. So, if you had, and this is going to be an oddball question because it's going to relate to movies, favorite orchestrator, movie related. So
right. I gotta go with Danny Elfman.
Oingo Boingo or after Oingo Boingo?
All of it.
Nice.
It's, but you know, when I heard, you know, when I 89 Batman, I mean, pretty much anything Danny Elfman's done, I like. I mean, some of the films I haven't seen, but the ones I have seen myself, absolutely fantastic. And just awesome. And Oingo Boingo is great. I've got, you know, some of their stuff. So, you know, just a really versatile composer, musician. The guy's great. He can sing and play guitar, which is always awesome. And I always think that's a plus when you can sing and play at the same time. A lot of guys can't do that. And that's why they're vocalists. So, you know, hey, they're great singers, but I mean, to play and sing it, be a front man and play really awesome rhythm parts, because I think that's great, and he's one of those guys. So,
was
you know,
Batman his first orchestration? I thought Batman was.
It might have been his first big one, but it might have been. He, that definitely put him on the map. I mean, besides Oingo Boingo, but as far as the movie scores, I believe so. I would have to check into that to give an honest answer, but I agree with you. To my knowledge, that's when I first heard him. I mean, I was 8 years old. You know, I was my son's age, you know. And, but who's your, yours is John Williams, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was sold as a kid. Star Wars had such a huge impact on me. You know, the music for it, even the newer ones that John Williams has composed, and you know, just to, you know, Jaws, the intro for that, the way he wrote that, the intensity of it. I think his music that he writes, his orchestrations for movies, the music just fits the mood. And he's also, you know, like you said about Danny Elfman, he's an accomplished guitarist as well. So I encourage people to go and check out some of his stuff too that he does on the acoustic guitar. He's very talented, very talented.
Yeah. Yeah, and also Jerry Goldsmith. Let's not forget Jerry Goldsmith is amazing. Did Hoosiers? He did a bunch of Star Trek.
Yep.
The guy's done everything. He did The Burbs, which is one of my favorite soundtracks of all time. It's such a funny movie. But I mean, he brought out the comedy in that, but also had kind of a dark, macabre kind of feel too, because a lot of some of the you know, more darker aspects of that film, the guy could do it all. He could do it all, and he's definitely another one. And there's a few other Star Trek guys that their names just slipped my mind, but it's
James Horner.
There you go, that's the guy.
Yep.
He did the motion picture, and he did one through three.
Yeah, he wrote the score for Star Trek II. I want to say in like a day or two, he was. I don't remember if he was under the gun or not, but that is also another original soundtrack that stands out to me when I was young. I got back when they had the drive-in movie theaters, not the recent ones, but the older ones. Star Trek II is one of the movies I actually got to see on the big screen in that soundtrack. You know, it's unforgettable in my opinion.
Yeah, and for TV, my favorite guy would probably have to be Mike Post. He did the A-Team. He's done everything. He did the A-Team. He did like Hill Street Blues, and he also did Magnum P.I. And so I love all that stuff. And someday I hope that they release the, you know, a soundtrack for Magnum P.I. without, you know, at least some songs from the series like they did with the A-Team. So,
not the musicians, but the orchestration is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, Mike Post, there's a lot of similarities between the Magnum P.I. musical scores behind the action and stuff, and but there's a lot of really good string sections, more laid back stuff, but then the action stuff is really good, like the chase scenes and all that, and shootouts, and you know, it's really cool. And so yeah, that's awesome, and hopefully someday we'll see that. But you know, don't forget Stuart Copeland from The Police. He's an awesome composer. He's done all kinds of stuff. He's done all kinds of scores. The Equalizer is one of my favorite series that he's done. Just really out there music, but it sounds amazing. Just crazy. So,
yeah, we'll have to have a podcast on these gentlemen and some of the top films or TV shows that you like from them. We'll have to talk about those.
Great idea. Yeah. So I think if you don't have anything else, Ben, we could probably wrap this up. If you want to keep going, we can, but if you want to stop, we can stop. I'm open.
Yeah, let's do another one. Let's do top five bands currently next episode, and then maybe get a little bit more into some of the instruments that we have, maybe some of the gear that we're using with it, and maybe hopefully some people listen to this and give us some feedback on some topics that they want to hear from us too. So
yeah, I'll get the word out and work the social media page, and it'd be awesome. So, and I'll, you know, once we get a few more episodes, we'll get us up on Spotify, and you have to actually sign up for that. So,
So I'm going to leave a little hidden gem at the end of this, and hopefully he'll listen. I'm still waiting for that video from Paul McGinty that we talked about a couple years ago. He said something about live music. I think he was just promoting himself in the McSauce podcast. come on, man. Drop it. I want to see some video.
Solo acoustic extraordinaire.
Yeah.
He can sing and play at the same time. There's a guy, you know, he's got the goods, you know.
Yeah, we'll have to ask him how he does it. Does he count at the same time he's singing? Does he hold his tongue to the left side of his cheek?
You might mess him up because now he's going to think about it the next. I'm ruined.
All right. Folks. Well, till next episode, guys. Thanks. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll have you listen again here soon. Leave comments when you can.
Yep. Quick plugs. Watch. Listen to the McSauce podcast. the Case in Point podcast. hope this finds you well, and a fireside chat. They're all friends of mine, and they're friends of Ben, because Ben, you interact with them. So we'll see you guys next time.
And if you want to hear Justin's and my songs, I actually have them out on reverbnation.com/benstape. You can go out there and listen to it. You can also find it on my Twitter tag, Ben11776. There's a link for it there, too. So if you're wondering what Justin and I are doing and the music stuff that we're doing and you want to follow, just go ahead and take a peek. And if you like it, and join up and follow the adventure that we're doing.
All right, folks. You be safe out there, and happy February.